Now, quick question. Jung and what's he writing about? I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I will tell you this. I think part of the problem is, in my view, that we're in a patriarchal age. Our egos are patriarchal. And so that applies to men and women. So his writing is about starting where we are, which is patriarchal, and getting us out of it. Now, that does give it a masculine slant. But I think that's because that's where we are as a civilization. True, he was, you know, I think on the other side, you can say legitimately, he was working on his own problems. Mm-hmm. And he was a man. I think on your side, I would say, you know, it's a shame there aren't more texts by and about women that we've interpreted. The problem is, there aren't any. Because it's a patriarchal civilization.
You know, even here we have two women who are pastors and mm-hmm. a man. That some people say, I just cannot go when she's speaking. I mean, women are saying that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Catholic Church, they just have... Oh. They come to the Episcopal Church and say, oh, I can't imagine what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is still very, very prominent.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good book called The Shadow King. Bring it in. It's all about the patriarchy in men and women.
That's from an anthropological kind of no.
But I think one of the problems is that women, particularly when they first went into business, and I remember talking to the men, said we really wanted the feminine approach, but they turned into the mm-hmm. masculine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot our fault.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That the women, when they started out in the business world, turned into the masculine rather than bringing the feminine approach.
Because right.
That was the model.
That was the model.
Right. Mm-hmm. As already say.
And well, I don't know. But
now the next generation can do it differently. And it just takes seconds.
Well, I think it's true. I think it's changing. Men are changing with the presence of women.
Right.
And that will make it easier for women to be women.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just want to answer that question about mm-hmm. this, what does seem like a masculine bias in the
mm-hmm.
writing. Okay, so we spent a lot of time on that sentence, but on the middle 49, but I thought it was very, very important that you get this idea that, really, I guess kind of as Nancy put it, we are one organism, and when there is a creative shift in our life, that's going to affect us relationally, and it's going to affect us creatively. And we tend to think of those things as separate, but they're the same. I work with some artists who I know when they get charged to create, they get so sexually charged they have to stay inside. I mean, they're afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And when that work comes out, it's gone.
Look at the lives of Picasso mm-hmm. and various other
yeah.
artists.
Yeah.
One woman after another. Just to put painting could have gotten done. All comes out in paintbrush.
Okay. I think we've made our point. The other thing which I wanted to look at was... well, let's go. Maybe just go through it. Two boys, two dark boys and a light girl. I think we can dispense with the two kids pretty easily, two boys, as Jung's comment there on, where'd you go on page, where'd you do it? On the middle of 49, that it's ego and shadow, and there's an issue of immaturity. That's not the interesting point. I think the interesting point is this business of the teacher of the girl and the normal mathematics. As I said, he interprets that as I Ching. Now, this is my own personal feeling. This is not what the author says. That the normal mathematics for the unconscious is taking numbers as symbols. And numbers are a symbol of what? The Spirit. And that's what Pauli's anima is in, not in a position to grasp. Which is a fancy way of saying he can't grasp that. He will not be able to understand the spiritual significance of his sexual feelings. Or the creative significance of his sexual feelings.
So if the girl that can't grasp that number thing, you say that means Pauli.
His anima. It's still too immature to differentiate between an experience and its meaning. And those of you, you know, most of you here have, you know, been involved in the inner journey and have been studying, and this may seem like so something to be taken for granted, but it is a high level of consciousness. Most people, when they want something, they want something. And tell them to think about what it means, they'll tell you what to do to yourself. They cannot grasp that a desire could be a symbol. That is a very late development in consciousness, and many people do not have it. They simply cannot reflect on their desire. A desire is something you fulfill. End of story. And you see, when you try to bring this in to them, what it's like, you run into this bunker and nothing gets through. So I think that's where Pauli is. He cannot yet work symbolically with his emotional experience. And I think that's what the dream, that's how I understand what the dream is telling us. And the popularity is the route that Pauli took. And remember, this is at the hands of a stranger. Stranger being that archetypal, the archetypal life in matter. Spirit in matter, if you will. Okay, so that.
So one of the boys seems to be smarter than the other.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, Jung takes that as ego and shadow.
Oh, yeah. So one of them is more developed.
Yeah, the ego is more developed than the shadow. Which means the Pauli is going to be a little dishonest in his dealing with things.
Now, Jung said that they tend to go together, right? Yeah. Oh. One goes up, the other one goes up in some kind of...
Yeah.
So they won't be too far out of...
Yeah, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
The big deal is the girl. That's why I didn't spend much time on the boys.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I mean, all of us are more or less in that shape. We've worked on ourselves, we have some consciousness of our BS, but sometimes, despite ourselves, we act in a less than desirable way.
Why is it the girl that is given this role?
Because she's the anima.
The anima. Uh-huh. In other words, the anima is a source of his ability to begin to relate the symbol.
The anima would be his an image of his ability to relate, period. His a personification of his relationship capacity, and it's young, and it cannot work with different levels of experience. Now, that's the main point of the dream. I think if you're interested, I'd like to take just a little detour. I mean, it's what the author talks about. We could skip over for the sake of time, but it's very interesting, I think. It's on page 50. The author then just goes back and talks again about synchronicity after the dream. And then he quotes this this passage from Heisenberg, who is relating what Bohr said to him. You see where I am on top of 50. This is just tangentially related to what we talked about, but I thought it was so good because of the movie What the Bleep. Did you all see that? It's the only thing I've seen that contradicts that movie. And I thought it might be just for the sake of our own interest, interesting to look at that. The movie, I think, in my to my feeling, had an agenda. It wouldn't probably admit that, but the agenda was that there's a worldview implicit in quantum physics, and that is that the quantum physicist makes a choice in the way he looks at the atom. And that determines what he sees. Does that all sound familiar to everybody? So if he does an experiment one way, he's going to see the electron in the atom as a wave. If he does an experiment another way, he's going to see the electron in the atom as a particle. And that's really the conclusions of Pauli, Bohr, and Heisenberg. That's the Copenhagen interpretation. And what they then conclude from that is that reality is both. It's both a particle and a wave, and so you have to look at nature through a stereoscopic vision. You can no longer look at nature in the old way that X equals Y, because X equals Y equals Z at the electron level. That's just standard. Then where this has been taken in pop psych is it's interpreted metaphorically to say, you see, you create your own life. That was the basic message of, I felt, of What the Bleep. That because quantum physics shows us that the results of the experiment are something you create, that metaphorically, that's the birth of a new myth, which is showing us that life is what you create. It's totally will. So I thought, let's look at what the father of the Copenhagen interpretation said about this. It's actually a little different and quite interesting, I thought. I'll read it. It's not going to be easy. Now, I got to tell you that I'm not sure about the translation. That first paragraph is what I translated. The second paragraph is what was published in the English translation of that book. But I know that translation's wrong. I know that's wrong. I'm not sure about mine, but I think it's close enough for our purposes. So let me read it and then just hear what Niels Bohr says about the philosophical implications, in his view, of quantum mechanics. When the discussion finally turns to the intervention of God, naturally it is not in terms of the event's conditions from the point of view of the natural sciences that one speaks, but rather in terms of the context that links the event to other events or to human thinking. Now this is the important sentence. This context belongs to reality every bit as much as do the conditions of natural science. And it would be a gross oversimplification if one were to ascribe the context solely to a subjective aspect of reality. Let's try to put that in our own words. So I think it might help you if I diagram it.
The E is electron. This is how I. So this is the atom.
You can't just talk about yourself seeing an object, because there's a context that makes that possible. Something in the world is allowing us to see whether that electron is a particle or a wave. So to simply say, I see the wave, cuts out the thing that allows me to see it. And that is not a subjective aspect of reality. That is an objective aspect of reality. The possibility of my being able to see it isn't something that is just in me. It is something in reality. It's a fine point. I don't know if it makes sense or not.
Yeah, it does.
So you simply can't say, I see it. You have to say, there is a medium that is allowing me to see it. Or there is a medium which is relating me to it so that I can see it. And not only does it relate myself and the object here, it relates objects to each other. That is not a subjective creation of my perceptive system. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It's still been boiled down to, it's your perception.
It's your perception, but mediated through the possibility of seeing it.
Even though it's mediated through something, like be that an electron microscope or...
No, he's not talking about the tool, but about the principle of nature that allows perceptions to occur in the first place.
The principle of nature,
that allows perceptions to occur in the first place. That's what I understand by him saying the context that links the events to other events and to human thinking. There's a linking going on in the perception, which is not solely a consequence of my perceiving it. It's what allows my perception to occur in the first place. So to simply say that an act of perception is a creation misses the fact that it is as much created by nature's allowing it to happen as by my doing it. See, again, it takes the emphasis off the ego. So where that, what I would say, populist interpretation of the meaning of quantum physics leaves us is in egotism.
Yeah, you create your own reality.
You create your own reality.
Well, I don't totally disagree with what you said, but I also thought what Luke was saying is that, for me, I got out of it was that reality is like an illusion. And I can also see what you're saying,
yeah,
that there's something allows us to see through, lifts the veil of illusion.
Right.
At different times, but it's still an illusion. Even the veil,
yeah,
is an illusion.
Well, see, he's not saying that, though.
No, but... Well, to me, it is in a way. Because what allows you to lift the veil of illusion? And what is the veil of illusion?
But there is no veil of illusion because the nature is allowing the perception to occur by the nature of nature. It's a different point of view.
Gary, it's one way to think about it is back when humans were coming to consciousness, we made ourselves the subject and everything else the object.
Exactly.
So now what this is saying is that we're relating subject to subject.
Exactly. And that's a good way to put it.
Subject has its own reality that's looking back at us. But, I mean, what I'm saying there is that we've created a duality that has the subject and the object as a split. And what this is saying is that it's the phenomenological point of view. We're subject to subject.
Mm-hmm.
So that everything isn't based on our norm or our perception, mm-hmm, of it. It is its own subject.
You could say subject to subject. Now, this is not quite right. But that there is a subjectiveness in nature which is allowing that perception to occur.
Right.
And it's its own subject. Thing. Nothing to do with me.
Right.
And that's what you don't get. Right.
And that's hard for us to understand.
It's very hard.
Of the way our consciousness has,
right,
developed, where we split ourselves,
right,
off from it,
right,
and saw then our relationship, we created our own relationship,
yeah,
to it.
If I try to paraphrase it, what the populist interpretation is saying is, oh, look what we see. And he's saying, look what it is that allows us to see. That's the difference. And that is just as much a feature of reality as the thing that we're seeing. And I think it cuts through this sort of egocentric view that's being extracted from quantum stuff. And I thought it was interesting that the guy who developed the quantum stuff thought about that 70, 80 years ago.
So you'd say something allows us to see...
To see, period.
To see in an objective manner that we...
That we're linked to the thing we see.
And so we're not influencing it.
I wouldn't say that. But that to say we are simply creating it is wrong, because there is something that's allowing it to be created. And that it's allowing the things that we see impinging on each other to impinge on each other.
Well, the popularizers would say that's co-creating.
You're right.
That's what he also said out of that. Okay. But the idea of tools that you brought up, I thought that was important, because sometimes when you measure the atom or you observe the atom, it's observed under certain circumstances as a wave, and then other times it's observed as a particle. And it seems that the tools of perception really do play a role, not necessarily in changing the phenomena observed, but for changing the act of perception.
Absolutely, it's true. It's what conclusions can you draw from that philosophically? What implications can you draw from that philosophically? And he's saying you can't simply draw from that. We create a perception, because there is an objective fact allowing us to be linked to the thing which we are seeing.
It is an objective factor
which allows us to be linked to the thing we are seeing.
Well, that's definite Gertzanian science. That whole union of subject and object, I mean, that's certainly...
I bet he might have gotten it from Goethe. I mean, because...
That Letterman says, and probably is the kind of evolution of that thought, that... and he shows how that developed all the way back to the early Greek philosophy.
Yeah.
That reality is both chance and necessity.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the chance is, I think, what you're saying, is you, that's outside of us.
Right.
But then within that, what comes up, there is a necessity built in as to what can be. He talks about, like, for example, dice. You don't know, you roll them, you don't know which one's going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
But you do know what are the possibilities within that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always in life the chance, but there is also a necessity built into it. In quantum physics, you think about that the particle, there's an indeterminacy factor in where the particle is. But there is certainty built into it also, that you can, at least in a large number of particles, you can figure out where they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that point you mentioned, which we're going to see too, which I think is kind of exciting here, is that underneath all these concepts, we're going to see old mythological ideas. Mm-hmm. That's coming up.
Now, this viewpoint, how would you compare it with the Buddhist thought, you know, of the veil?
It's different.
Well, it seems different. I'm just wondering how you see that difference.
The veil is just as real as anything.
Well, in Buddhism, you don't create the illusions yourself, do you? That they speak of, right? They're just there, right? Okay. So in a way, it's agreeing with the Buddhist
Buddhists say it's all illusion.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is an illusion, but that's not what this is talking about. This is a different... It's like the difference between perception. It's kind of the difference between the way you see it in a spiritual realm and the way you see it in the material realm, the realm of perception. That in the perception of things, there's not a veil. It just is, subject to subject.
Yeah, it's certainly not an Eastern viewpoint here, I don't think. Well, anyway, you can You can ponder on that. It's almost a koan, probably, speaking of Buddhism. But I just wanted to give you another way of looking at things, because you'll probably hear, you know, this movie referred to, particularly if you discuss this.
There's another version coming out.
Is there?
Mm-hmm. Which movie is this?
What the Bleep?
Down the Rabbit Hole. It's going to be Image of Downtown.
What the Bleep, do you know? What was it called?
Mm-hmm. That's, somebody at CTS is doing a course on that this spring.
The money that bankrolled that film, was that Romsa character that did that channeled entity?
Right, right.
Yeah, they bankrolled that. So, I mean, there's an agenda beyond what you're talking about philosophically. Oh, yeah, when you start talking like this, then she had talked about man sex and all that sort of stuff. I mean, crying out loud. To put that in context with what's his name, Fred Wolf?
Yeah, right. I know.
It brings him down instead of elevates the channeling stuff.
There were two objectives going on there, as I thought.
Yes.
Physics, and then Rob's, or whatever her name is.
She got way too much airtime, screen time, and that's why. She wrote the checks.
I didn't realize that.
You know what, Gary, and I don't know this, but what you're talking about is something I've been thinking about. And I think this is very important, personally, because I think what this is allowing is us to move away from everything being personal.
Yeah, exactly.
And that we are participating in something that there is an impersonalness, and that we take everything personally.
And
I don't know exactly what all that means.
Well,
but there feels like that's a really important part of where all of this is going.
What I didn't like about the movie, and I'm not just trying to talk about a movie, but a general way of looking at things, the net result of that point of view is narcissism. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Me, me, me. Mm-hmm. What about the objective reality of the other? It doesn't exist, because you are what I think you are. And philosophically, I think he is showing us why that is not true. Because perception is not really subjective. There is an objective capacity making that possible. And that must also be taken account of in the conclusions we draw from these scientific theories. That's why I thought it was so beautiful. And the fact that he would have said that probably in the 30s, really, I think it shows, first of all, how brilliant he was and how thoughtful a man he was as well.
Could you relate it to synchronicity?
Yeah.
Like those, the observer and then the two.
Because remember, he says, when the discussion turns to the intervention of God. That's his first sentence. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we are linked to the objects of perception, and that's how it is that a synchronicity can determine us. Mm-hmm. It's not the question merely of my perception of it, but its perception of me. Mm-hmm. As if to say, it is perceiving me. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I got from that.
That's why I put it up there, yeah.
I have to go personal. The bear claws in my mm-hmm. thing, the bear claws in Joanne Fabric,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm here. So
exactly.
Oh, well,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
You see, and there, to simply say you're seeing this, and that is you're creating that reality, ignores that those two things are seeing each other.
Right. And they're seeing me.
And they're seeing you.
Right.
And is the line across your, is that some... the symbol of the intervention?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Now, what are those two things they're seeing each other? The actual object and the ability to...
Well, yeah, how did the bear claw buttons know to be there after Sandy had the dream about the bear claws?
So what are the two things that the...
Well, starting with the physics, it's two electrons. But if we take it as a metaphor, take the events in the atom as a metaphor for events in life, then they are the two events in synchronicity. And that's what these people are doing. They're taking that the theory of physics, and they're interpreting the events in the electron as a paradigm for events in life. And I'm trying to show that their understanding of the event in the electron is false. And therefore, so is their conclusion. And it's actually a very dangerous conclusion.
Because they perceive...
The only thing that's important...
Making up reality first?
They assume that the observer makes up the reality. And they forget that there is something linking that observer to reality. And that's just as important as the fact that they are seeing.
Okay.
not to mention, who knows what the devil's going on this side of things, that is creating the thing that I'm seeing. Yeah. Just as is there a linkage here and here, there's a linkage here and here. And that sounds like a trite little argument to talk about two electrons, but it's not so trite when you talk about a synchronistic experience. That there is something going on that brought the dream and the reality together that's linking that, which has nothing to do with you. This would be what Jung calls absolute knowledge.
I sort of just kind of ask you. So that's what the impression I got from what the belief is, that they covered a lot of territory, but they left out the transcendent.
Mm-hmm. Absolute knowledge. Because absolute knowledge is not subjectively created. It may be subjectively perceived, but its existence has nothing to do with you. With your ego.
You know, part of the challenge is that the world we've created, we name it our language. And mm-hmm. so our language carries with it a certain viewpoint, and it's so hard to get out of. So what they did in that movie was they took a narrative, they took her story, and they put it through a particular lens.
Right.
There are other ways you could read that story.
Right.
That would put you in the imaginal realm. It would bring other things in that we don't quite have the language or we can sort of dispense them. We haven't really named them yet.
And for my taste, that's one of the values of doing this work, is that we go back also. Pauli was trying to do this, I think, in his best days. Go back and really examine the scientific theory, and then really examine the implications of it for our self-understanding. Just like our self-understanding shifted when we realized the Earth wasn't the center of the universe, our self-understanding now should also shift based on these new conclusions, because science is finally a myth. And he's taking the trouble to try to do it correctly. I feel there's a lot of it being done maybe not so correctly, and I just wanted to give us a chance to develop the tools to distinguish. How do we begin to understand the personal, the religious, even the political implications of quantum theory?
Well, the physicists are attacking Lovely too.
Good.
I have to reread my article.
Well, as I say, I wasn't trying to just knock down a particular movie, but to give us tools to realize how what are all the factors involved as articulated by these guys who really try to go into it, not only theoretically, but personally.
Yeah, it's important because a lot of people are giving us a lot of ideas.
Yeah. I think it's particularly important because, as I said, if you may feel, I hope you don't, but you may feel, oh, this science stuff is so dry and objective, who cares? But if you go back and you look at the history of science, the history of our self-concept has always evolved along with the history of our view of the material world. And I think it's no different now. That what we've got here in the scientific work is really seeds of how we are to begin to change the way we understand ourselves. And then you might say, well, why is it occurring in science and not in religion? Because religion's dead. This is the place of the spirit, so to speak, speaking to us. And this is the myth. This is where the images are coming through now, like they came through to Paul 2,000 years ago. So in a way, these physicists are the prophets. I mean, not directly, but their unconscious is being moved by forces that are on one level purely theoretical and scientific, but if you begin to see them as metaphor, you realize how deeply meaningful they are for our self-concept. And what I liked about what Bohr says, it shows us we must begin considering the objective nature of reality that allows us to be in the first place. And that is so contrary to our me society. And I don't think it's an accident that those two have occurred together.
The last point I want to bring up is the thing about the objective observer and the very limited knowledge of that seem to be that what I understood then, it was that we had
because we were observing it, it was something about whether it was a particle or a wave, and I'm losing it already.
Try it.
But the place I'm at now is just the flip side, that it is that particle and the wave that are influencing the observer.
That would be a synchronicity.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So how do you do it the other way and not get in that ego narcissistic?
I don't think you can do it the other way.
Okay.
See, with legitimacy.
You can't. Okay.
I don't think you can.
Okay.
I think as soon as you say you create your reality, you're stuck in self-centeredness.
Right. Because you're saying that you're creating, whether it's a particle or a wave.
Mm-hmm.
It's what I understood, mm-hmm. and I never...
No, that is not untrue.
Well, I was thinking that it might really a little bit in Zarathustra, Jung was talking about how importantly we must consider that the soul, if you want to call it, the inner nature, is both bodily and spirit in time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the other way around, and back the other way.
Yeah.
Which we don't normally do. We think of the body as just that lower species, but he really made a point that the body is intimately concerned with this higher dimension of soul.
Yeah. And there, I think, you can say we can draw a valid conclusion from quantum mechanics that you must always realize that one thing is two things. That is valid. It is not valid to say that the world is simply created by your choice. Because the world is created by the fact that it allows you to perceive. And that is, as he says, every bit as much, every bit as much as the conditions in natural science. In other words, the events in the electron. And it would be a gross oversimplification if one were to ascribe the context solely to a subjective aspect of reality.
This article is saying that, he says, many physicists today say the waves that symbolize quantum possibilities are so fragile they collapse with a slight encounter with their environment. Conscious observers are not needed because they're able to predict this collapse with mathematics and probabilistic terms. That's what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying the desires and intentions of the observer have nothing to do with it because they can predict it mathematically.
But how would you know?
Yeah, but just because they can predict it doesn't mean the events actually occur. It's a theory, it's speculation that something would happen if all the conditions of an equation were fulfilled.
I guess what they're saying is it follows the law of nature.
And yeah, but how would you know?
How does he
actually
say? He just says that they can predict.
But see, as soon as you know it, you've intervened with the system.
What he's saying is that he has mathematics that can describe the collapse from wave to particle.
I understand that, but where I think he's off is how would you know?
How would he know that happened?
No. And as soon as he does know, he's back here.
Well, I suppose he's saying that they're observing.
Yeah, that's the point. That's the point.
Now, what's your point, Gary?
I don't know.
I really want to know. Once he can prove it, he's injected himself into the proof.
Exactly.
Because he's there.
Right. There is no such thing as a reality which is not seen.
How is it happening?
Right.
How would you know it's always going to happen if you don't always go show that it does always happen?
Right.
What about those incredible moments where maybe it doesn't?
Yeah.
So,
right. Thank you,
Nancy. Okay. Well, anyway, he's agreeing with you.
I don't think he is agreeing with you.
Well, he said it.
Second word.
I agree with Gary. Okay, I'm sorry.
He says the desires and intentions of the observer have nothing to do with it. So he's saying, like you're saying, that...
Yeah, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that's part of it, but there's mm-hmm. something else also.
Right, there's another agent.
There's another factor, maybe. We do get into words, but I like his choice of words, context. Context and linking between me and the phenomenon is as much as me seeing the phenomenon. what links me to it is not me. My perception of it might be determined by me, but what links me to it isn't me. It's really not all that.
What that does is go a step beyond Einstein, doesn't it, in terms of his relativity concept, which they fought so much over there. Because Einstein would say it's just the relationship.
Yeah.
Are your perception
right
on
right
contact?
Yeah, that's like too far off.
Yeah, yeah.
They certainly could not agree. They were good friends, but they couldn't agree. Well, that gets us to 50. Someday we'll pick up speed. Well, we're laying groundwork still. We are still really laying groundwork. And we'll pick up with, as I said, what we discussed today about this last bit doesn't really apply to Pauli. It does a little bit in that he is trying to get back to the metaphor. I just did it because I thought the author brings in that passage, which was a great tool to give you to begin to critique what you hear in Pop Psych about this very issue. But that takes us basically to Dream 13, which is where we'll pick up.